I'm Michelle Martin. This is Tell Me More from NPR News. Coming up, you get to tell us more. It's our weekly Backtalk segment, your response to a story we brought you about a father meeting his teenage daughter for the first time. But first, when Leah Scholl graduated from seminary in the year 2000, most of her classmates went on to preach from traditional pulpits and churches. But Scholl took a different path. She began a ministry for exotic dancers. It's called Starlight Ministries, and since 2001, it's expanded both in size and scope. Now, she and a team of mainly women volunteers offer services, even financial planning, to exotic dancers. Leah Scholl joins us in the studio here in Washington. Welcome. Thanks for speaking with us.
Hi, thanks very much for having me.
How did you start? I mean, and was it a kind of thing where did you dream it up one day and say, this is what I'm meant to do?
I had actually trained to work with a welfare-to-work program and had investigated being a chaplain to a prison. Didn't really fit with me. And then someone said to me, how would you like to train to go visit strip clubs? So I went into the strip club, and as I was sitting there that first day, it just sort of settled in with me. This is it. This is what I'm supposed to be doing.
So is that how you work? You visit the strip clubs?
We visit the strip clubs usually in teams of two or three people. We take gifts to the women. We are there to answer questions, to pray with them, to talk with them, and we try to build relationships. We visit regularly once a month so that they can come to us, and when they need something specific, we try to help with that.
So you're based in Richmond, Virginia?
I live in Richmond.
And is that where you do most of your work?
We have teams that visit in Washington, D.C., in Richmond, Virginia, in Atlanta, and also in Birmingham, Alabama. I provide training for other organizations that want to do this same sort of work. And like in Atlanta right now, I'm training about 100 people to do the same sort of ministry. So
what do? You walk in and introduce yourself? Do you wear your clerical collar?
No.
Carry a Bible?
No. No, actually, I just wear jeans, and I walk in, and I usually tell the bouncer who I am, why I'm there. Sometimes they'll send us to the dressing room, and we'll meet with the dancers there. Sometimes we'll take a table in the club and sit, and the dancers can come over and approach us.
How do the club owners react to your presence? Because I actually have done some reporting in strip clubs, and, you know, outsiders are not always a welcome presence. If you're not there to spend money or to participate in the experience, they're not always interested in having you. That's been my experience. So how are you
right.
treated?
Our goal is to not impact the economics of the club, and so they don't seem to mind us all that much. A happy dancer makes more money, and if she has seen someone who's made her day better, then she might make more money in the club that day. They're pretty welcoming once they get to know us. At first, they give us suspicious looks. They expect that we're going to be judgmental of the dancers and of them and of the clientele. And when they find out that we're not, then they go, oh, we're really glad that you're here.
What do you say?
Most of the time, a dancer will come over to me and say, I don't like what I'm doing. Don't judge me for what I'm doing. And I respond with, I don't judge you for what you're doing. I think you're great. I think that you're here, and I'm just really glad to see you.
Why don't you judge what they're doing? I mean, at the end of the day, isn't your ministry rooted in the concept that this is something from which these women need to be saved?
These are young women who are 18 to 24 years of age. Many of them believe that because they've made the decision to be exotic dancers, they've ruined their life, that they don't deserve another chance. And I don't believe that that's true of anybody. Everybody deserves a second chance. We are not trying to get the women to quit working in strip clubs. They will quit working in strip clubs when it's time for them to quit working in strip clubs. We try to support them as they do it. I don't think that it's the best place for a woman to work, but I understand the frustration of having the bill collectors call, of not being able to feed your kids, or Christmas coming and not being able to buy them any gifts and that sort of thing. And I understand that economically, sometimes it's just necessary to go do something that doesn't seem like it's such a great idea.
You said that these women made the choice to do this. Is it your view that indeed they have chosen?
Probably choice is a bad choice of words. When it comes to economics, do I choose to feed my kids? Or do I choose to take my clothes off? Those are my options. I think I'd go with feeding my kids. There are women there who don't believe that they can do anything else. That's the only thing that they're good at and understand and can make a living at. One of the things we try to remind them is that with education, with support, they can find other kinds of jobs. Lily Barana, who's written a book called Strip City, sort of calls it the ass versus McDonald's syndrome. She says that McDonald's doesn't know what it does for the stripping industry, because everybody says, well, it could be worse. I could be working at McDonald's making $7.50 an hour and smelling like grease every day. That's the option that the women seem to think that they have. They can work for minimum wage, or they can work and make actually a good living.
Is it a good living?
It can be actually really good money. It can be as much as a mid-level executive. I know dancers who make over $100,000 a year in Birmingham at small clubs. On the other hand, it can be pretty bad. I mean, I talked to a dancer the other day who had made $6 that night, not even enough to pay for the cab to and from work. And she's in a large market and a club that makes good money, but every dancer has to pay to come in and dance at the club.
Wait a minute, they're paying?
They are independent contractors, and in order to come in and work in a club, the club owner will require generally that you pay a stage fee. That can be anywhere from $20 to $100 in a night. That you have generally a quota of how many lap dances you have to do, and you have to pay a percentage of that quota to the club. And usually they have to tip the bartender, they have to tip the DJ, they have to tip security, all those sorts of folks. And all of that is before they make any money.
It sounds like indentured servitude. It sounds like, the kind of farming system that arose after slavery, which
right.
is that I will give you the feed and I'll give you the, a place to live, and in
Absolutely.
Exchange for that, I get to take all your profits. So then the question arises, your time be better spent getting legislation passed to outlaw those kinds of practices, those kinds of business practices?
I think in some way it might be good, but that's not what I'm called to do. I'm called to build relationships with the dancers and to love the dancers. And I hope somebody is working on that, but that's not my gig.
If you're just joining us, I'm speaking with Leah Scholl. Her outreach group, Starlight Ministries, ministers to exotic dancers. Theologically, how do you see your work?
I absolutely hate the whole idea of love the sinner and hate the sin, because I don't believe that you can hate the sin and love the sinner at the same time, because I think that that's a value judgment when you say, I hate your sin. But it's odd. It's sex and it's religion all mixed in together, and so people are really nervous when you put those two things together. But for me, it's threefold. One is that we're all created in the image of God. Two is that God doesn't make any junk and doesn't throw anybody away for making mistakes. And three, that we all are put here with a purpose, and these women all have a purpose, and helping them some way realize that purpose, I think, is why we're here.
The thing that interests me about the whole world of exotic dancing and, having interviewed exotic dancers or people who worked in the porn industry, for mm-hmm. example. On the one hand, many times they'll defend it. They'll say, this is my right. I like it.
Absolutely.
This is what I want to do.
Mm-hmm.
This is something I like. Other people may like stamp collecting or, fighting fires for a living. This is what I like. I like taking my clothes off for money.
Right.
On the other hand, many of these women will also share a story of abuse. Many of them will say that they come from households where they were sexually abused.
Mm-hmm.
How do you reconcile those things? What do you do with that? I mean, first of all, is that true in your experience? Are many of the women in this industry coming from an experience of abuse?
I don't like to generalize in that way. I think everybody wants to go into a club and say there's got to be something wrong with them in order for them to have done this. I don't know if that's necessarily across the board true. But I look at, I can tell you a specific situation. A young woman I was working with had been raped as a very small child and also abused by a neighborhood teenager when she was 9 or 10. And when she started dancing, for her, it was liberating to be the one to decide when she got to take her clothes off. That was a point of liberation for her, and it stayed with her for probably the first 6 or 8 months that she worked in the clubs. But what I've noticed just from knowing these women is that the first 6 or 8 months are really fun. It's, hey, you get to go in, you get to take your clothes off for men, you get to get all this attention, you make lots of money, and you get to drink on the job, all that sort of thing. And then at about 6 or 8 months, the job satisfaction goes down. Drug and alcohol abuse go up. The times that they spend crying before they go to work, that goes up. I don't know what causes that moment, but somewhere around 6 or 8 months, it's no longer fun. And the bills get higher, and the pay actually goes down after 6 or 8 months, because when you're new, it's all really great and shiny, and then it's, just kind of goes down from there. And what happens during that time, too, is women all go in with a set of boundaries. And because of the drug and alcohol abuse, the boundaries move just a little bit. So they find themselves doing things that initially they didn't think they were going to do. One friend who sort of woke up from a fog one day and was out in the parking lot with a client, giving him a And she had had very specific rules. She would lap dance, but she wouldn't touch the client. And then she had gotten to the touching part. And then she would touch the client, but she wouldn't touch his genitals and that sort of thing. And so here she was, you know, one day just sort of like, oh, my gosh, I have gone further than I ever wanted to go. And at that point, she was like, well, I've done it this one time, so it doesn't really matter if I do it again. And when she kind of, like, she doesn't work in clubs anymore, and when she kind of came out of that, she just was like, that was something, somewhere I never wanted to go and never wanted to find myself in. And so she's done a lot of work with counseling to kind of come back and forgive herself for those sorts of things that she had done. And so part of it is, so what happens next? It's not like you can sit down and write a resume out for all the strip clubs that you've worked at. So where do you go from here? And you've moved those boundaries to the point where you think it's not worth even having any boundaries, so you end up in porn or you end up doing prostitution or working on the streets or wherever you do. And we try to provide options for that so that that's not where they end up.
What are the options you can provide, given, as you pointed out, there is this stigma?
If you're filling out your resume and you don't know what kind of job skills you have, you know, we have counselors and stuff who will do pro bono work for us. They can do resume writing and things like that. And I tell dancers all the time, you know, they say, I'm not leaving with any skills. It's like, boy, you have the best skill ever. You can read people. I mean, most exotic dancers can, a client can walk into the club and she'll know how much he's going to spend that day. She can read people. They also read our teams. I mean, they walk in and if there's any judgment at all, those women know. And so they have transferable job skills. So we help them identify what those transferable job skills are. And then we also, having known the women and been friends with them, we provide references. You know, I mean, there are some people in what one of my dancer friends calls the outside world who know you and who trust you and know that you're trustworthy and have resources. Like, you know, we all know someone and can say, hey, I have this friend. And can even give the prospective employers the idea that, hey, she was a dancer, but it's okay. You can go into a job where they never knew, and if anybody finds out, it can be really
a trouble. You sort of provide a bridge or a trusted advocate.
Absolutely.
Right, to the outside world. And what about you? How long do you think you can do this work? Many people who touch other people's pain burn out.
I don't really worry about burnout with this population because it's not just the bad. You do see the bad, but you see all the good, too. You see how smart young women are and how vibrant they are and what their lives can be. And you see them achieving those things on a regular basis. And it's like, wow, you know, this is cool.
Leah Scholl is the founder and the director of Starlight Ministries. It's an outreach to exotic dancers. She joined us here in the studios in Washington. Thank you.
Thank you.